one of the things that I was thinking of as I was reading it, knowing that you've been working on this book for a number of years, and being about rescue workers, and it was post, you wrote pre 9/11 and you wrote it post 9/11. Did that inform the way that you wrote it at all, any approach that you took?
It didn't. If anything, what it did was throw a monkey wrench into the works in the middle of my doing this, because I was trying to sell the book to agents and editors, and it was very hard for the nation to think of anything but 9/11 and terrorism for about 3 or 4 years. So as soon as that happened in 2001, everybody saw firefighters in one way. You know, they saw them as the heroic guys from the New York department that went into that building and you know, then it collapsed. And really, how could you not? I mean, the nation was just transfixed by that kind of bravery and that kind of terror and horror. But in terms of the publishing industry, which is very slow to embrace, you know, new stuff, they're very slow. For about 3 years, all they wanted to see was disaster-related stuff, and mostly New York stuff. Mm-hmm. So if it didn't have to do with the World Trade Center coming down, it had to have some other huge disaster written all over it. Like there was a big fire in Worcester where 6 guys died, really tragic fire. So they just got into a mindset that the only thing that people would be interested in was something very catastrophic and very focused on one place. Mm-hmm. And so the reactions I would get would be, well, it's not about 9/11. You know, it's not about Worcester. And where's Troy, New York? You know, why would anybody be interested in Troy, New York? I had editors say to me, well, if you said it in Miami or Chicago, we'd buy the book.
Wow.
I said, come on, guys.
Well, you know, being familiar with Troy and having worked in Troy and lived in the Albany area, it really gave me a whole new perspective on Troy and the range of incidents that these people face every day,
right,
and their passion for it, really. I mean, there's definitely a sense that this is what they're doing this for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, Troy really just becomes representative of any small city or a large city. What rescuers do, what people in professional fire departments do, does not change. Doesn't matter whether you're in L.A., Miami, Chicago, New York City, Troy, anywhere. Mm-hmm. And for most volunteers, it's true also, although volunteers tend to be in more remote places, so they have a different set of circumstances than professional urban fire departments. But, you know, it's all emergencies. It doesn't matter where you are. If somebody has a problem, whether it's a fire or they need to be rescued or they're having a medical emergency, they call whoever's there, whoever public safety is. Mm-hmm. In Troy, it happens to be a professional fire department. So when you call, you get fire, rescue, EMS. And the guys there are all EMTs. Half of them or so now are paramedics. And so the people who come to you are trained to give you emergency medical care.
We're talking with Bill Patrick and his new book, Saving Troy. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back. You're listening to WCFM. We're here this morning with author Bill Patrick and his new book, Saving Troy, A Year with Firefighters and Paramedics in a Battered City. If you have any questions, you want to give us a call, it's 413-597-2197. So, Bill, while I was reading your book, I also saw the movie Capote, which was all about the nonfiction novel and In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Did you set out to write a nonfiction book? Correct.
I did. Mm-hmm.
Do you in watching the movie Capote? I don't know much about Capote. And I haven't read In Cold Blood, but in watching the film, it felt to me as though the author he wanted certain information from these people so that he could get his book.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach this type of writing? Do you have an end in mind, or does it develop from the material that you gather?
Good question. I haven't seen the movie Capote, although I'd love to. I have read In Cold Blood, and it really was a seminal work of nonfiction, of what's now called creative nonfiction, literary nonfiction, literary journalism, immersion journalism. There are lots of names for it. Capote and Mailer and Joan Didion and Annie Dillard, you know, people like that were really pioneers. Gay Talese, there are lots of people, John McPhee. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, they really blazed the trail for all the people who are doing it now. And there are plenty of good people doing immersion journalism. Basically, it just means that the writer puts himself or herself in a place where they wouldn't normally be. Usually an occupation, or they shadow somebody to do a profile. And basically you immerse yourself in their world, and you try to represent their world without being, usually without being a character yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Some people become characters in their own work, but you know, I tried not to in this book. It's tough when you go to a place where you don't know anything. And I knew nothing about firefighting when I got there. I didn't want to be a firefighter when I was a kid. I wasn't especially enamored of them. I didn't care one way or the other. I mean, like anybody else, if there was a house on fire, I would stop and look at it and think, wow, look at that. That's pretty amazing and powerful. But I didn't much care about being a firefighter. So going in that first day, for me, it was just a writing project. It was just a good idea. And I had no sense of what I was going to find in there. I think Capote's take on In Cold Blood was very, very different. You know, the Clutter murder in Kansas was national news. And everybody was buzzing about that in its time. And so Capote, I think, went in with a very specific plan in mind. My plan was pretty simple. Go ride for a year, see if there's a story there, tell the story of that fire department. I got to say that I was totally shocked when I realized what the job was. It wasn't what I thought it was. It wasn't the siren goes off, you jump on a rig, off you go, you put the fire out, everybody cheers.
Mm-hmm.
It has almost nothing to do with that. 80% of the calls in Troy, and probably in most professional departments that have EMS, are emergency medical calls. Now, most of them are not advanced life support calls where you've got to administer usually an intravenous drip or put in drugs like atropine or epinephrine to start the heart. But they are emergency medical calls. And so these guys are put in a weird position. Mostly it's a blue-collar occupation. Most of these people have high school educations, but not college educations. Many of them now are trained as EMTs or paramedics, which means that they have at least an advanced degree in that kind of emergency medicine.
Mm-hmm.
They're not doctors, but they've gone to school for a year and a half to learn how to do this. And they're put in this weird position of having to be almost social workers, almost nurses, almost nurturers, at the same time that they're being relatively macho firefighters who are supposed to run into buildings that are on fire. And so you get a weird kind of schizophrenia in the department. I don't mean that clinically. I just mean you get that split where some guys don't necessarily want to be nurturers, And at 3 in the morning, after you had 20 calls in a day, and you show up for, something which is like an annoying regular who calls you once every 3 days, at 3 in the morning, you're not really much in the mood to, nurse somebody through their hypochondria.
Mm-hmm.
So it sets up a weird dichotomy for those people. I didn't expect that. And so not only did I have to figure out how the fire department worked, I had to figure out how emergency medical care worked and learn all of the technical information and jargon that they use. So I was just awash for about 3 or 4 months. I had no idea what I was doing. And tended to annoy everybody because I would ask them hundreds of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And was constantly writing, recording everything on audio cassette. And so it's a pretty complicated job these days.
One of many things that I also learned, that I thought about afterwards, if I was in Troy in an emergency, I would call the fire department. And you touched on the whole private ambulance situation and the difference between the private ambulances versus the city fire department and paramedics,
mm-hmm.
and the response time and the probably, I would hazard a guess, quality of care to some degree, in my own personal opinion. Has that changed at all in Troy?
It's changed in a very big way. A year or so after I finished writing, Troy was successful in getting its own ambulances.
Great.
So now they do deliver ambulance care for advanced life support calls. But that's been a double-edged sword, as it turns out. It's been great for the people of Troy because response time is the most important thing. If you have a life-threatening condition like a heart attack or a stroke, it really is important how long it takes somebody to get there to help you. In some cases, you have about 6 minutes before oxygen, before brains that are deprived of oxygen start to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
But they suffer fast. And so if you don't have a department which is going to get to you in 2 or 3 minutes, you're probably cooked. And if you've got an ambulance, I shouldn't name their names probably, but the ambulance companies that exist in the capital region have to do a lot of different things. They've got a lot of well-trained, good people who work on these ambulances, but they're businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And most of their business will come not necessarily from emergency medical calls, but will come from transporting elderly patients to and from nursing homes, to hospitals and back, to medical calls, to medical appointments. And so, you know, if you've got a fleet of, say, 10, I don't know what their fleets are, but if you have 10 of them and you've got 15 calls, somebody's going to have to wait.
Mm-hmm.
And if that person waiting is you and you're having a heart attack, you know, you're out of luck. And in that case, it's really a life and death situation. So the Troy Fire Department has at least they have two ambulances and I think two or three other advanced life support rigs. So unless you have six or seven calls immediately, they're going to get to you fast.
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody in some station that's going to get to you who's trained as a paramedic.
Right.
And so that's a big difference. But when I rode, it was a real problem. Because the medics would show up, they'd have somebody who would be have undergone a trauma, and they'd need transport. And if an ambulance wasn't available to come in and give them transport, that endangered the patient a lot.
Mm-hmm. In riding around and being part of so many incidents, how did you cope with that at first? I'm sure there were some traumatic things that we in everyday life aren't familiar with, and how did that impact you? And also, are there any incidents that stand out for you in particular that you want to talk about?
Yeah, lots. I coped badly with it at first. It took me a long time to understand how I should act and how I should feel and what I should do on the calls. The very first call, I'll talk about that. We were in a training session upstairs in the fire department to show you how clueless I was. I was just sitting there, you know, watching the training session, and a tone went off. It isn't exactly a bell, but a tone went off. A couple of guys stood up and walked out of the room. Another tone went off. A couple more guys stood up, walked out of the room. And the chief looked at me and he said, "Well, are you going?" And I said, "Where?" And he said, "Go jump on a truck if you want to see a call." So I ran downstairs and jumped on a truck, and off we went to a call. Which, and of course, I didn't know what it was. It was an unknown unconscious, whatever that meant at the time. And we got there, and what it was a guy who was dead in a chair watching TV. And he was an older man. I don't know how old now. Maybe 75. I can't remember how old he was right now. But his family was in the room. His daughter, a couple of grandchildren, several other members of the family who didn't identify themselves. And they were all crying and all upset. And the daughter was getting very testy with the captain who was asking her information because there was her father, and he was dead sitting in this chair with a TV on. And I didn't know what to expect when I walked in, but having to confront the grief of the family, just I went right over the edge. I immediately started feeling empathic. I started crying and realized, God, you know, here I am with these guys. I can't start crying. You know, I can't feel this measure of empathy with these mm-hmm. people. Because, after all, that's not the job. And it hadn't occurred to me, except hypothetically, up until that moment, what the job was. And I realized, okay, the job is you're going to find a lot of dead people. And you're going to find their families, and they're going to be upset, and they're going to be crying. And you know, I said to myself, how are you going to deal with that? Well, I thought, okay, I can handle the dead guy. You know, he's dead. How bad can it be? The next call was supposed to be a 350-pound child stuck on a toilet. Well, as it turned out, it was a 550-pound, 45-year-old woman who had been in the bathroom on the toilet for 27 hours.
That was amazing to
yeah.
read about.
Yeah, well, it was
disturbing.
Shocking to see, let me tell you.
Yeah.
And her father, who had been in the apartment the entire time, had not called for help for 27 hours. And so there's a call where, once again, I go in and I think, well, you know, I mean, how bad can it be? She's not dead. Okay, so she's really, really huge. Okay, you know, I can deal with that. But as the call went on, it got more and more surrealistic. You know, they ended up having to take everything out of the bathroom, the sink, everything out, because they couldn't fit her through the door. And then when they started to fit her through the door, she got stuck. And the father is jabbering in my ear the whole time about working, you know, on the smokestacks at Samaritan Hospital. And I just thought, this is a little too whacked out for me. And then when they brought her out, it still hadn't hit me that this was a life and death situation. They put her on the stretcher and she died. The weight of her chest was so great that it crushed her lungs and she couldn't breathe. So every time I turned around on one of these calls, I was faced not only with the mortality of somebody else, but with my own inability to be professional around that mortality. And it took, you know, a couple of months. It didn't take a long time for me to understand how to act professionally with the other guys or on a call.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got that right away. You know, you don't laugh, you don't cry, you don't do those things. But did I deal with it emotionally? No. Inside, I was a mess. But that was good, because having not been prepared for it, I began to see what it would be like for these guys who saw it every day for sometimes 25, 30 years.
Right.
So what are they going through? And the book is much more about them. It's not really about me much. At the very end, I talk a little about my process.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, it's a book about them. And this is true for rescuers all over the world. We've just seen the disaster in New Orleans, the Gulf Coast with Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are so many disasters now, you can't even, you know, shake a stick at them.
Right.
The rescuers in these situations are going through the same kinds of emotional trauma that professional firefighters go through. And unless you do it, it's hard to understand what it is. Because you can't hypothetically make yourself emotionally stronger. And until you see a horrible situation, you don't know what it feels like, and you don't know how much you need dark humor to mm-hmm. deal with that. And that's how the firefighters get through it, basically. They have a chaplain who comes in sometimes for the really terrible things, like child mortality, kids who die in fires, which happened that year. It's in the book. But mostly, they make jokes about it. And once again, that seems inappropriate if you're on the outside, because you think, well, how can you joke about something like that?
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Bill Patrick, the author of Saving Troy. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back after this. You're listening to WCFM. We're here with author Bill Patrick with his new book, Saving Troy, A Year with Firefighters and Paramedics in a Battered City, set in Troy, New York, right over the mountains from Williamstown. And I just want to read one of the reviews about the book. This story crackles. It positively tingles with immediacy. You are there with Troy's firefighters doing what they do three-quarters of the time, racing to save the bleeding, the burned, the overdosed, the drowning, the poisoned, and the delivering mother. And for the other quarter, they lay their lives on the line within flaming buildings, performing the most dangerous profession in America, the firefighter. Bill, you write about many rather graphic incidents. Some might call disturbing, but I think it was important in the telling of the story. How do you approach presenting those true-to-life incidents in a form where you're not making the reader turn away necessarily, but continuing to read on?
That's a good question. Tough balance. There's a lot of very, very gritty stuff in this book, and people do turn away from it sometimes. A lot of people say they, you know, are reading this book before they go to bed, and they just can't read it too much before they go to bed because there's a lot of disturbing stuff in it. I try to leaven that disturbing stuff with other humorous incidents or stories from the firefighters or other things. I try to create some sort of balance. But I think, you know, we just don't get a lot of real stuff in society. We get reality TV shows that are scripted. We get, you know, news bites that are 12 seconds or 15 seconds, or we get the, you know, immense coverage of Katrina, you know, day after day after day of watching the same video clips on CNN. But we don't usually get what people go through on an ordinary day in a dangerous occupation. And what I've put in this book is such a small part of what these guys do. When I stop and see the firefighters now, as I have been recently, there's always something amazing. There have been two or three fires in Troy this week. There was a fire set by a guy who was found running around naked in the alley outside the apartment with a dream catcher hanging from his genitalia a couple of days ago in Troy. Troy's a whacked out town.
It is.
And I could have put thousands of calls, all of which have the same intensity, immediacy, and grittiness in this book. It wasn't like I chose, you know, the most graphic stuff to put in this book.
Mm-hmm.
I chose the memorable calls, but also lots of ordinary calls from that year. I don't know what to say about the grittiness. I think people just don't understand what these people do on a daily basis. And if you do, you realize, okay, how do you present that to a reader without showing the real thing that happens?
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there's Chapter 5 is about a 19-year-old RPI pre-med student who had gone to Times Square on New Year's Eve, and he was, unbeknownst to his family and lots of other people, a heroin addict. And he had two other friends who were also heroin addicts, had gone to New York to score drugs, have some fun in Times Square. They did that. They came back. They had been shooting up all night long. And he came back, and he went into a kind of coma, an overdose of sorts. And when we got to him, he'd been down for about 45 minutes, and we couldn't bring him back. And it was an immensely grotesque scene. I was just shocked. And I was 3 or 4 months into the job at that point, mm-hmm. so I'd seen a lot of stuff, but this was really grim. And I didn't present it in totally grim fashion, but I did talk about, you know, what he looked like, what kinds of rescue efforts the paramedics performed on him. The chapter begins with his brother coming into the hospital and flipping out and using, you know, really horrible, obscene, racist language, which he was wrong about, actually, because the friends of the guy were white, not black, and so this guy was just showing how much of a racist he was. But how do you present that call without showing that real stuff? Mm-hmm. And so I show that real stuff. You know, maybe it's just that many other things are soft-pedaled these days and we're not used to it. But I try to give the reader the same situation, same experience I had. Mm-hmm. I try to put you in between the paramedics in the front seat of the medic rig, and you see everything I saw. There's lots of dialogue. It's all present tense. I try to make it as immediate as possible.
I thought the choice and the range of the incidents that you present in the book are interesting, that they show a range of what they're dealing with every day. And, yeah, there were some parts where I kind of had to turn away or put it down and come back to it. But I thought it only... It made the book even stronger, because you needed to know that.
Thanks.
To see the other... Then to hear the firefighters talk in those bridge chapters and hear their... You understand more why they're struggling with what they're struggling with internally,
right.
And between each other. So I... Although it is graphic, I thought it was important to the story.
Well, you know, one other quick note. The stakes are very high. It's a life and death job. And so in the book, the stakes have to be high, too. Otherwise, it won't do service to it.
Do you think... Or are you interested in writing a nonfiction novel again? And do you think you could... I'm thinking of another type of person that you could write, who else you could observe for that long? Could it be as compelling, or does it have to have that element of maybe the unknown, danger maybe?
Good question. I'm not sure how to answer it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, thinking of the... In that terms of observing someone else's daily life, would it be as interesting to observe, you know... a DJ,
Well, it wouldn't have the same life and death, I hope. I hope not. I don't want to do a sequel. I mean, all the firefighters in Troy say, oh, come right now, do it again. You know, I don't want to do the same book again.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful way of life, and I say it that way because when I was there, I saw a brotherhood that I'd never seen before. Most of us just go do our jobs, you know, and we have good relationships often with the people where we work, and you do your job, and that's that. The fire department's completely different. These guys, they have a second home there, and they have a second extended family. Not that all of them get along, but then again, families don't all get along either. But these guys, if they need something, they're there to help. Mm-hmm. And that was very unusual, I thought. And after a few months, they accepted me into that family. And so, you know, I would be very compelled to go and show more characters and show that again. I just don't want to repeat it. Don't want to do the same book again. I love creative nonfiction. It'd be fun to do another project, although I'm working on a novel now. So in the future, it's got to be spontaneous. It's got to present itself in a way that this one did, just kind of out of the blue.
What was the firefighters' response to the book itself? Have they all read it?
Most of them that I've talked to have probably. Well, now some of the guys are retired. There are 4 or 5 who are retired, but most of them are still on the job. Everybody who's read it has loved it. Firefighters are not, and once again, here comes a generalization. I'm not trying to impugn anybody, but the firefighters that I've worked with are not big readers. They read occasionally. You know, they like to watch movies. They're certainly very articulate. They're great storytellers. They're fun to be around, but they're not guys with 1,500 volumes in their living room that they take down every night, like most of America. You know, they're not huge readers. All of them go through this book in a day. They just love it. And firefighters love to read about themselves, as do EMTs and paramedics and first responders. And for some reason, that profession, emergency medical care, loves to read about what it does. And I don't blame them. It's exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them who've read it like it, and their concern is not, is it a good book? Their concern is it accurate?
Right.
And all of them say 100%, you know, that I nailed it right on the nose.
That's great. And interesting, also in the structure of the book, you intersperse news articles about certain situations or incidents. Did you find in there seemed to be some comparison between sensationalism and journalism and the reality and the firefighters' response to some of those articles or the people writing those articles. Did they, and in fact at one point one of the writers actually at the fire station talking with them, do they have a relationship with journalists on a whole? I mean, do they, is there a back and forth? They like reading about themselves. They're often in the paper because of things that happen.
Sure.
What's that kind of relationship, and how did it compare to being a writer who's writing a novel and your relationship with them?
Well, they just accepted me as one of them after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't like I was even a writer. Although they remembered that I was a writer, it was more like I was just the guy who was there riding along.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't concentrating on the writing part of it. I think many of them were shocked when the book came out that actually there was a book and that I had been working on it, you know, because it took a long time to get it out there. But they don't have the same kind of relationship with journalists. There are always photographers, as I said, television reporters, photographers, videographers hanging around for special stories, and often there are reporters coming around, but they don't tend to deal with the rank and file much. They tend to go to the chief, Tommy Garrett, right now to ask, you know, mm-hmm. for official information. It's almost like with the police department, they don't grab a cop on the beat. They go to the chief or whoever the spokesperson or the PR person for the department is.
Right.
So firefighters don't see them all the time, but they'll see them occasionally. And they're wary of reporters. You know, you don't want to say something that gets you in hot water with your boss.
Mm-hmm.
Or you don't want to say the wrong thing. And certainly you don't want to create a liability situation for yourself. So they're very wary about that. They do tend to get interviewed by television reporters on the scene a lot. They'll come out of a fire, there'll be a camera there, they'll say, well, what's it like in there? And they'll say something.
Hot.
Hot. Smoky. I couldn't see.
Right.
And I need a drink of water, please.
I can only imagine that after 18 months you had mountains of information.
Way too much.
What was your process in going through that and deciding how to present the information? I know you've done it in a couple of formats, both with the book. There are photographs in the book, which you took all of the photographs, and then the DVD.
I did. Yeah, I did all that. The DVD I put together with a friend, Tom Cahill, who was an old student of mine from St. Rose, and we put that together last year in the editing suite at St. Rose. So I didn't do any of the technical editing. I don't know how to do that. I did all the narrative editing and sort of the line editing of it, but he really put it together. The photography I did myself, and of course all the writing. Here's my cautionary advice. For if there are any writers listening, anybody wants to do immersion journalism, do not do this the way I did it. do not try this at home. Here's how I did it. I decided I had to tape every call to get all the dialogue correct and all the sounds and everything else. Well, that resulted in 221 90-minute audio cassettes, all of which is fine. You know, you can label them all and organize them and put them on racks in your writing room. But then you have to do something with them. And what I did with them is I listened to every single tape after I'd finished writing, and I made a tape inventory. And that tape inventory was 140 pages long.
Wow.
It took me a year just to do that. Okay. And I cursed myself the whole time, all the way through. At the beginning, middle, end, it's not like it took a long time to dawn on me that it was way too much work to do this book. So that was that. I did 1,100 photographs. That was a little easier. You know, that means I only had, I don't know, 40 or so sheets, you know, to go through, of slides to go through. And I had 5 notebooks, and that, of course, was the easiest because those were all dated. And the tape inventory was the key to it because, you know, I don't care if you rode for 3 months or 6 months or a year. Within 2 or 3 months, you've forgotten a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
and you've got to recreate it. Doesn't matter whether it was 10 years ago, 5 years ago, last year, you've got to recreate your experience always because the experience is just right there, spontaneous, immediate. I mean, if you ask me in 15 minutes all the things we talked about in this interview, I will not be able to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
If you go through a 24-hour day in a fire department, 8 a.m. one day till 8 a.m. the next day, sometimes you see 20, 25, 30 calls. How do you remember the first call?
Right.
How do you remember what the room where the first person who had a heart attack looked like or smelled like, or what one firefighter said to another? So a year later, how do you remember what happened on that first day? It's impossible. So the entire task of writing becomes one of recreation.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you got to have source material. My primary source material was audio cassettes, which was great. It means that the book has an intense immediacy because, you know, there's lots of detail, lots of observation, lots of, you know, spot-on dialogue because I had the tapes to review, and I could listen to them over and over until I got exactly what that firefighter said in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen if you're just taking notes.
Right. And so how long did it take you to complete the book?
Why do you ask that question?
And were you tired of people asking you, have you finished it yet?
Oh, God, I was so tired. I was tired of asking myself, you know, is it finished yet? But, yeah, I got really grumpy by the end about it. I spent the first, after I finished writing, which is mid-90s, I spent the first probably 3 years writing a screenplay, writing the radio play, getting that produced, putting all of the material together in perspective, and doing a proposal. I had an agent, Don Congdon, at the time. Great agent. William Styron's agent, Ray Bradbury's agent, Ellen Gilchrist's agent. I thought, wow, I am so lucky I got this great agent. And we went out there with a 125-page proposal. You know, this is late 90s. And sent it around. And the reaction that I got was pretty much the same. Either, one, we don't care about firefighters. Or, two, who cares about Troy, New York, again. Mm-hmm. And so I just didn't know what to do. I was really flabbergasted about that. And took a year and a half off and wrote my last book, the memoir. Excuse me. And then I went back at it around 2000, 2001. So the book was written in 5 years, about. But, of course, all that initial work took 3 or 4 years also, in which I was trying to grapple with the material, trying to figure out how to present it, what the narrative structure was, who was going to be speaking, point of view, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked on the whole thing 10 years, but the actual writing was 4 to 5 years. Too darn long.
We're talking with Bill Patrick, the author of Saving Troy. He rode for 18 months with the firefighters and paramedics in Troy, New York, and has written about it in his latest book. You can purchase the book directly from the publisher at hudsonwhitman.com or visiting a local bookstore. We're gonna visit Water Street Books, aren't we?
We are.
Okay.
We are.
See if we can get it there, but you can purchase it in Troy at Market Block Books or in Albany at the Bookhouse in Stuyvesant Plaza. Once again, the website is hudsonwhitman.com. Anything else you want to say before we head out today?
Well, one little commercial note. It's also available at Borders Books.
Oh, great.
On Wolf Road in Colony, and also at the Barnes & Noble at the University of Albany.
Excellent.
So there are a couple of other places I can get it.
It's really a fascinating read. I highly recommend it. And, Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Sandra, thanks so much.
You're listening to WCFM.